about these accounts or something or another that we really like. This is one of mine here, Luke chapter 4, which I have cleverly titled Jesus in the Synagogue, because that's what it is. It's where Jesus is in the synagogue. It starts in Luke chapter 4, verse 14, and goes down to the end of the chapter there in verse 30. And this is really an opportunity to see the Master at work while teaching in the synagogue. And I think that's where the drawing power is here. I think it's something that shows something of Jewish life. It's interesting. And it shows how Jesus taught and has a lot to say about culture and custom and other things like that. So it's always had, you know, a multiple of things in there that I've thought were really appealing. And what we're going to do, we're going to go through here and look at a few things and not just read it all at once, but portions of it as we go along. But I want everybody to notice some particulars at the very beginning. This is at Nazareth. Now you can see that in verse 16. That's where this takes place. So this would be a place where he would be well known. And in the synagogue, it says there in verse 16, on the Sabbath day. Now, synagogues originated during the Babylonian captivity. They couldn't go back to Jerusalem. They couldn't go to the temple to worship and other things like that. So now what are we going to do? So synagogues became the place to worship. And a synagogue was originally any gathering where people were to be taught. And that's kind of how it works. I think we understand that the synagogue referred to the gathering. That's really what it means. It means a gathering. And then it was transferred over to the place, the building. It's kind of like what we've done with the English word church. We understand it would refer to the people in the gathering, but then it's transferred over and been assigned lots of times to the building. It might be inaccurate. I understand all that, but that's what happens. And the synagogue in Jerusalem, I found this fascinating. Barnes says in his commentary that there were about 480 synagogues in Jerusalem at one time. And I just, that number just seems to me to be beyond imagination. I mean, how far apart were all these? And I thought, I don't know whether that number's accurate or not. Got no idea how to say yes or no with it. But then I also think to myself, how about if it was half that number? If it was 240, I think that'd be a lot of them anyway. You know, so I think the idea is there were a lot of them in Jerusalem. Now, there might not have been in other cities, like in Ephesus and some of the other places that you find different ones, but there would have been a lot more in Jerusalem. Now, a synagogue existed where there were at least 10 men who agreed to consistently meet for worship. That was just a custom. That's how they decided that would work. And the Jews met in synagogues on the Sabbath, of course, and on feast days. But then they also had additional meetings, which came about, and it would be on the second and fifth days of the week. So at least they're going to be meeting three times a week. Sometimes they might be meeting four. Now, what was going on? Well, you can see as we go along here, there's a reading of the law. And the law was divided into sections, and the five books of Moses and portions of the prophets. They did not consider the idea of the law just being limited to the first five books. I think today religious ideas are that the law is just the Ten Commandments. But the Jews had a much broader view of the law than that. And here we find that they're doing this. Now, they had this divided up so that the portions wouldn't be read at the same one, you know, like this one, and then the same thing five weeks later or something like that. They were divided up to where they would go through this, and then the entirety of what they considered to be the law would be read in a year. This was part, an essential part of Jewish public worship and teaching and everything else. It wasn't necessarily confined to those who were properly the ministers of religion. And you see here in this account that that's the case. The what was called the rulers of the synagogue could assign to persons as they chose that they knew were capable. First of all, they had to be capable of reading it, and then perhaps expanding on it somewhat. So they sometimes did confer this upon strangers, and they often invited them to give the people an exhortation on subjects, as the passage is suggesting here. And although Jesus wouldn't be a stranger, but he probably had been away and traveling enough that he wasn't a regular in this particular synagogue. Now, if you look at Acts chapter 13 and verse 15, it says there, and they're in the synagogue. We've been studying on this part of it, but they're in the synagogue. And it says, after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them, saying, "Men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on." So there you got the idea of what they did. So it wasn't something that was closed. It was open to a certain degree and so on. So let's look at verses 14 through 16 real quick here. Jesus returned, that's in Luke chapter 4, verses 14 through 16. Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and news of him, or fame, some translations have, went out through all the surrounding region, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. So he'd been to more than just one synagogue. But this time he's at Nazareth, where he'd been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. Well, what do we have here? Well, the temptation is past. That's what happened in the first few passages there in chapter 4. So really, this is kind of the beginning of his ministry. It would be real early in that. And you see that I always think to myself, he did this early on, teaching in the synagogues and so on. And then I think that you can kind of see this reflected in what Paul's pattern was. When he went to a city, the first thing he did was find a synagogue in that city, and then he would go there and begin to teach there. Now, he would go to other places, of course, after that, but that's what he always did. So he starts in the synagogue, Jesus starting here in the synagogue. And when it says here about returning in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, there's something interesting to note. And this happened early on. John chapter 3 and verse 34, there's something here that says this. Now, this is about Jesus. You start back there earlier in chapter 3, and you find out it's addressing things about Jesus. Like in verse 31, it says, "He who comes from above." Well, who doesn't know that's not referring to Jesus? But then it goes on down to here. Now, this is in verse 34. "He whom God has sent," again, that would indicate Jesus, "speaks the words of God." More indication of it being Jesus. Then it says here, "For God does not give the Spirit by measure," meaning he doesn't give the Spirit by measure to him. Now, there are others, they might receive the Spirit, but they would receive it by measure. In other words, a certain portion, what was necessary at the moment, perhaps, or something like that. But with Jesus, that wasn't the case. He had the full measure of the Spirit as he entered this phase of life. And we can understand how that would be an important thing. And then the word that's translated as, I mentioned there, fame. Now, it says in other translations, I've got the New King James tonight, it says the news of him. King James, I know, has fame.
And really, I think to myself, it might fame might be better than just news, because the original word implies that there's talk that's rapidly running about in every direction. You know, it indicates something that's spreading quickly. And news doesn't always do that. But now fame, that's what happens from the result of that kind of thing. But now what this tells us is that Jesus had acquired now a reputation. Think about this. How he's just starting out and everything, but he's gained a reputation of sorts. And of course, that reputation would be viewed in a number of different ways. But he's teaching in the synagogues, which he had already been doing. There's a knowledge of all this. People have heard about it. And what's happened here is that it's apparently well enough known to have excited some interest when he enters the synagogue in Nazareth. Now, the reading that he does begins in chapter 17, and we'll go down through verse 20 this time. He was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." Then he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all who were in the synagogue were fixed on him. Well, I think that's really interesting. Now, you might have noticed if you got a translation that comes, the King James and the New King James comes from what's called the Received Text, the Greek text. All other translations and newer translations, NIV, the New American Standard, American Standard, and so on, they come from the Westcott-Hort text, and there's differences in them. That's why the Bibles are different. And you won't find "he has sent me to heal the brokenhearted" in the Westcott-Hort text and the Bibles that reflect that. I don't think that changes matters much. I think it's kind of just expanding on what was said in conjunction with that. But now let's go to Isaiah chapter 61 and notice where this is found. And again, this isn't word for word, but it's easy to see that this is where this comes from. Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 and 2. "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." Now that's where the reading would end. The rest of it says, "the day of vengeance of our God to comfort all who mourn." So Jesus didn't read all of verse 2, but a good portion of it. And this is a marvelous pronouncement, I think, of the mission of the Messiah. And this is the thing. Everyone in that assembly would know that these passages in Isaiah addressed the Messiah. There wouldn't have been any question about that at all. Wasn't any before Jesus read this. Wouldn't have been any after he read it. And there really wouldn't have been any while he was reading it. And if you notice, the passage speaks of one who has been anointed. Well, the anointed one. That's what Messiah means. Messiah is Hebrew. It means the anointed one. Christ is not his last name. It's a descriptive title. It's Greek, and it means the anointed one. Messiah, Christ, they mean the same thing. They're just got different origins of language. But the Messiah or the Christ is the anointed one, so that's who Isaiah chapter 61 is talking about. And when we see it here, that's what they would understand. That's what we should understand as well. And then it goes on to point out what this one would do. Now you can go down through here and look at all these things. And it is at first easy to see that these are physical things. When you think about the healing and the recovery of the sight and other things. And Jesus did all that, didn't he? Sure. But what happens is we fail sometimes to consider that this would also have some spiritual meaning to it. You know, to do what? Well, to preach the gospel to the poor, there's that. But to proclaim liberty, freedom from sin. And what else? Well, how about recovery of sight? I think that the idea is that those that don't have the gospel, well, they're blind. And so he's going to open up their eyes. He opened up the eyes of people who were blind, visually impaired, but now we're talking about this in a spiritual sense and having that. So I think we ought to look at this, you know, kind of both ways. Now, I understand that some people think that, well, it all ought to be about the former. And it's all about miracles and everything like that. And I think sometimes they think Jesus just came here to perform miracles and so on. And then, well, yeah, he said a few things too. That's almost how they're doing this. And I think that's a real problem. Let me catch up here. That's a real problem when you look at it that way. We forget the important thing that's said on more than one occasion. Something like this. In Luke chapter 19 and verse 10, the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. Now, he did do some signs and wonders. He did relieve the suffering of many people. But he didn't relieve the suffering of everybody. He healed some blind people. That's right. John chapter 9, he healed the man born blind. It's a lengthy reading, that's why I'm mentioning it. Were there other blind people in Israel? I'm sure that there were. What about them? It's nothing said about that. So that's not just everything that Jesus came to do. But he did come to seek and to save the lost. That was something that was available for everyone. Now as Jesus finishes this, all eyes are fastened on him. I've got the idea he's got their undivided attention of the assembly. They know what these passages are about, and they want to know what's going to be his comments on this. What's going to be his explanation? What's going to be his word of exhortation on this? And also, kind of notice how he stands up to speak, and he's standing up while he's reading, because after this he sits down. And he sits down to do what? He sits down to teach. And my understanding is that was the custom of the time in the synagogue. The third thing we want to look at is the explanation. That's in verses 21 and 22. Now he's got everybody's attention. And he states that this passage refers to him. He began to say to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." And so all bore witness to him and marveled at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, "Is this not Joseph's son?" So what's he saying here? Well, it's fulfilled in your hearing. What you heard about the Messiah, that's the one who has read these things to you. He's making a bold claim of being the Messiah. Now we know that that's proven out. But just think what kind of impact that would have had on everybody that's there and hearing this and so on. That he's the one that's been sent from God. So what had so stirred their interest in him was exactly what this passage said. It's not that he was going around claiming to be the Messiah and then he goes over here and finds something that verifies this. No. You know, this was the reading of the day. And so he's taking this and reading it, and then he's telling them, "This refers to me." So I think that's more than just coincidence. I think it's all providential, the timing of it and everything. And even though they acknowledged, you know, all that they had heard, and they and all about the reports that they had received of him, and so on, what do? Well, they begin to doubt, don't they? You see that? They begin to doubt. The Messiah coming from Joseph's family, a carpenter, this poor and humble, raising up and education and livelihood and all that. You know, behind this is almost this statement of, you're not really what we had in mind. And that's really sad when you think about, you know, how their reaction is to that. And here's another thing. I think a lot of times, you know, Jesus just isn't what people think that he ought to be or how they would like him to be. He's not. They're oftentimes surprised, you know, at Jesus. And I don't know where that comes. You know, there's this old statement. I was thinking about this a couple days ago. I had the sermon here in the can, so to speak. And I got to thinking about this, and I thought, well, there's a saying that we have. And the saying goes something like this, two things that you don't argue about. Have you heard it? What are the two things you don't argue about? Religion and politics. Why? Well, it becomes confrontational after a while. That's right. Oh, so don't do that. Now, there's a lot of folks that understand about, you know, the whole thing about confrontation. And they don't think that Christians ought to be confrontational. Now, I don't think we need to be out here seeking confrontation, challenging people. We don't need to be obnoxious about it. I've seen and heard street preachers that were that way. You know, they were just, that's what it was. I don't know a better word for it. They're aggressive and obnoxious. That's not what it is. But at the same time, we don't want to be just completely passive and just let everything go and never a word and other things like that. And I thought to myself about Jesus, you see, because people think Jesus was never that way. Oh, he was never confrontational. He was always passive, you know, all the time and everything and so on. I don't think so. Do you? When you read about him with the Pharisees, now, he didn't start it all or anything. They'd start stuff. They would come in. Remember how they would come in there and try to set up something in order to trap him? And he would respond to them. And this kind of back and forth would keep going. And they just keep trying and trying and trying. And you can see, you know, how that was working with them and so on. Now, Jesus never lost his cool when all that was going on. Oftentimes they did. But he didn't. But this old idea about, you know, that some people have about Jesus, well, it's not the Jesus of the Bible. There's where the problem is. And there's lots of other things. I think when I have to marvel that folks with their preconceived idea about Jesus, when they read about him going into the temple and the animals and the money changers and everything else like that, and he makes a whip. A whip! And he's in there, and what does he do? He creates chaos. Can you imagine? He flips the tables over. He drives the animals out. It says drives them out. Some people say, well, he drove the animals out. I think he drove the people out too. Now, he might have been driving the animals out, and people are watching this, and they may become convinced he's going to be after us next. And they lied out of there. Can you what? You know, the courtyard in the temple was a series of walled-in areas with openings. And so all this is going on inside in one of the courtyards. I get maybe about the second layer of the courtyards. So you got people on the outside of this, and they hear the commotion. You know how that would be. They would hear the commotion start inside, and they think to themselves, well, I wonder what that is. And then here comes a stampede of animals and people out the door. Can you imagine the scene of this? I think that's got to just stun some people that that's Jesus that did all this. And he had zeal for the Father's house, so he says so. It shouldn't be a den of thieves. It ought to be a house of prayer. So you can see why he was doing that. But I think with some people, I don't know what they do with it. I guess they just have to just ignore it or think it's made up or somebody just didn't like Jesus, put that in the Bible. Or I don't know, but I think it presents problems with the preconceived notions. It's also good to look at the remainder of Luke chapter 4, because in verses 23 through 30, we see the reaction here. He said to them, "You will surely say this proverb to me, Physician, heal yourself. Whatever we have done in Capernaum, do also, whatever you have done, we have done in Capernaum, do also here in your country." Then he said, "Assuredly I say to you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. But I tell you truly, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a great famine throughout all the land. But to none of them was Elijah sent except to Zarephath in the region of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And many lepers were in Israel at the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian." And so all those in the synagogue now, watch this, when they heard these things, they were filled with wrath. Interesting word. It certainly means that they weren't too happy about what they just heard. And there's no confusion about that word, since wrath is the word that's used there. Anger, wrath. "And how much so? Well, they rose up and thrust him out of the city. They led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down over the cliff." Now, one person said that they probably wouldn't just do this themselves. You know, they probably just wouldn't be 5 or 6 strapping guys, grab him and drag him over there. But they wouldn't hardly do it that way. They wouldn't be that overt about it. What they would do is get him over here closer and closer to the edge, and they'd get closer and closer to the edge until this mass of people just kind of just, you know, crowd him off. That's how they would do it. And then they'd say, "Oh, no, we didn't touch him. We didn't throw him off. That one, it just happened, you know." And they'd get away with any kind of blame and so on with that. But now, this tells us that even though it might have happened that way, what they intended, you know, to put an end to him there. Then it says, "And passing through the midst of them, he went his way." Now, one of the things that Jesus has to say here, he's the one that brings this up about doing things that were done over in Capernaum and doing them here. He brings it up, not them. He brings it up. A lot of times we think that's what they were saying. But he says, no, that's what you're thinking and that's what you're wanting. He brings it up. I think that's interesting. Now, here's the thing though. Will signs prove what teaching evidently won't? Think about it. He's been teaching them, he explained it, he read the scriptures, told them what's going on. The fame of him has gone about. They know all these things. Will more signs convince some of you? Well, probably not. No. And what about signs? 2 times in Matthew chapter 12, verse 39, and Matthew chapter 16, verse 4, Jesus said that an evil and wicked generation asks for a sign, and no sign will be given. Well, so what are you supposed to go by? You go by what's been taught. That's what you do. I'm not here just to do signs. I do them. He's done them. But that's not what it is. And really, they've rejected him because of who he is. Joseph's son. And where he's from. From Nazareth. You know, you're from here. And so, what's the point? Nazareth has no special claim on me. That's really what his point is here. And then the widows of Israel, you see, all of them that there were, they didn't have any special claim on Elijah. The lepers of Israel had no special claim on Elisha. And those individuals, the widow and the leper, they were a Phoenician and a Syrian. I think that makes them Gentiles. And they were the ones
that received the blessing of God. And he's saying, but you're not going to do it just because you demand it. Can you understand why it has the word wrath there? You know, they're being told that Capernaum was better off than they were. They're furious about this. And you're worse than Phoenician widows and Syrian lepers. And so I think what happens here, they kind of forget where they're at, and this riot then begins to start. And their plans were to kill him. And no prophet is accepted in his own country. That's right. Now, a lot of times people will ask, you go through all this and everybody's interested in verse 30. I don't know why that is, but everybody, oh, how did he do this? How did he pass through the midst of them and then go on his way? I don't know how he did it. I'm agnostic on that. I got no idea I did that. I had listened to a man one time explain that at some length that he became invisible. People just couldn't see him. I thought that was hardly the answer, but I think it satisfied him fine. You know, I feel comfortable in saying I don't know how he did it, but I've got confidence that it did happen, and I think that's good enough. Now, just for a few minutes here, I want us to consider what we learn from this. Just a few things. One of the things I think that we learn from this is that Jesus always had a message that people needed. Now, there's just so many passages we could go to, but I wanted to go to one early on. And the one I thought was a good one is in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 23. This is early on. It would have been about this same time as the event in Luke 4. Jesus went about all Galilee, watch now, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing all kinds of sickness, all kinds of disease among them. We mentioned both of those things. He did both of them. But he had a message that people needed to hear. He's always had that. He's got a message that people need to hear today as well. Now, a second thing is, there needs to be a specific recognition of him. That's required. I'll tell you who required that. Jesus required that. He told the Jews who believed on him, unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. What do you mean by that, I am he? Well, they would understand that that would mean like the I am that spoke from the burning bush. And who was that? Well, that was the great I am, Jehovah, the Lord. You have to, what he's saying here is, you have to acknowledge, I am the Messiah. That's specific. That's what Jesus was saying here. And there's got to be that kind of recognition. It's not, oh yeah, I believe he lived, or I believe he was a philosopher. I believe he was a man who was had a lot of compassion and helped out a lot of people. All those things, you know, some measure might be true. But far more than that. No, he's the Messiah. He's the Son of God. And also, like with Nazareth, you know, we've got to learn that not everyone who heard Jesus accepted him. It didn't happen, you know, in his home country. I've got John up there, a couple of passages up there. And in John chapter 1 and verse 11, it says, you know, he came unto his own and they didn't receive him. Amazing thing. The one who they had been looking for so long. And here he comes and they won't have anything to do with him. In John chapter 3 and verse 18, everybody's familiar with verse 16. Sometimes folks are familiar with verse 17. How about verse 18? He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. Not everybody believes in Jesus. And even some that heard him, they did not believe in Jesus. And you can see that play out
as it goes along. And another thing, it's like we also saw in the reading, not everyone has a special claim on Jesus. I think there's that goes on a lot in religion today. I think there's a lot of this business that goes on, and it's just Jesus and me. You know, and nobody else, and what it is with Jesus and me, you know, it's special, and it's not like with anybody else, and other things like that, and it just goes on and on and on with those kinds of things. In other words, I've got a special claim here. Nobody does. No. They didn't then, they didn't now. That was his point, bringing up the widow and Naaman the leper. In Romans chapter 14 and verse 9, "For to this end Christ died and rose and lived again, that he might be Lord of both the dead and the living." All of them. The dead and the living. All of them. Everybody. No special claim. No. He's Lord of all. And then one more. I thought this one was pretty good. So there are lots of others we could look at, but this is a good one here. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 15, "He died for all, that those who live should live no longer for themselves, but for him who died for them and rose again." Now we can learn that. I'm sure we can learn lots of other things, but those are enough to, you know, give us some things to think about. Now take your songbooks, turn to the songs being selected. By the way of conclusion, I guess after looking at something like this and seeing what all went on and gaining a little more understanding of what took place there in the synagogue and what all this means, we're kind of left, I would think, with a question then, like those people did. What are you going to do with Jesus now? Well, it would have been nice if they would have believed him and acknowledged him as the Messiah and set about to put that into practice and follow him. Now, they didn't. They tried to crowd him out over a hill and kill him. But what are we going to do with Jesus? Are we going to believe him or not? I like what's said in John chapter 4 and verse 42. This is at the end of the account with the Samaritan woman. And after there were those, you know, she goes back and reports to the people in the city. And a number of them then, they don't just take her word for it. They go out to hear Jesus themselves. And so you get to verse 42. And then after all this, verse 41, it says, "Many believed because of his own word." And in verse 42, "They said to the woman, 'Now we believe, not because of what you said, but for we ourselves have heard him, and we know that this indeed is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, the Savior of the world.'" That's what we should do with Jesus. So we would encourage anyone tonight to lay hold of salvation, to become a child of God, or to make correction, that we might be following Jesus to the best of our abilities. Now is the time to do that. This is a good place. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.